I'm gonna read the intro to this chapbook and then maybe one poem from it. But I always sort of feel like I'm just writing the same poem over and over, so it is about poems that I'm not reading, but I think it will make sense as intro. Smear Jelly. Growing up, a book was a small capsule, a space or a room I could enter into. It was the excuse not to talk to people when interactions were potentially loaded with different kinds of harassment, embarrassment, tedium. The library, the bookstore, or the study, where the whole family would also sleep and eat in the winter, were spaces of solace. The book itself was a vehicle out of situations that promised a predictable chaos and pain. Inside of that space were difficult situations, but reading provided a sense of mastery over not just language, but also how one approached or encountered events, subjects, mystery, the uncanny, loneliness, a dark night, a riddle, the monstrous, or a landscape. The more I read, the more I felt the subtleties of that encounter, both as a reader and in terms of the craft of the story itself. World building was immensely important, and when the book, where the book might lack the details, I began to fill in the spaces. These were gaps I felt in real life as an immigrant kid. Any landscape I encountered seemed to lack the other landscapes I had encountered. I had the distinct sense that every cubic millimeter of air might be filled with stuff, angels, ghosts, worlds, and microbes. I'm interested in the ways that a poem might do similar work, that is, similar work to a time machine or related mechanism, and some of the work of world building without necessarily doing it in the ground up way, with the same logical flows associated with fiction. That's not to say I don't like writing fiction. The poem might work very well as a mechanism because it feels loose and less burdened by chronological plotting. The line break might very well break into another world. That space is wide open. The following slides, which are invisible to you, contain images that are smears of Sumi ink, manipulated, inverted, and made to resemble ghostly creatures that might live deep underwater. However, the resemblance is only that, an imprecise, non-anatomical. The smears contain traces of fingerprints. Even a precise fingerprint is an impression. The ink is a tracking device. A person is fingerprinted at the border or entering the jail. They are simultaneously entered into a database. When the smear is too imprecise, the person is asked by the guard to do it again, so the data can be clean and legible. The process tends to take a long time for the fingerprints to load, for the smears to register and appear on the screen. The waiting becomes a strange disciplinary process. The person waits for the results, hopes to do well, if only to move on faster, to escape the moment of extra scrutiny. The fingerprinting process has nothing to do with skill. It's merely the extraction of information. Yet the tension and exasperation persists throughout the process, as if the person temporarily detained is to blame for the illegibility of the information. These underwater creatures live because they are ineligible. In that moment between the border guard, prison guard, and the person detained, they manage to squirm out. They wait until the guard looks away to sabotage the data. I'm gonna read one short, sad poem from the actual chapbook. It's called Return Policy. The night I returned to the US coincides with the capture of the Boston Marathon bombers. I watched DHS agents tackle a woman to the ground in the room we are all temporarily detained in. For asking too many times what was happening and not sitting in her chair enough. They drag her away with her clothes torn, duty-free bag emptied on the floor. Something similar to a champagne toast as they tell each other afterwards, earshot of everyone else left in the room, that she was clearly asking for it. Why couldn't she stay in her chair? They shook their heads in unison. I have other poems for you. So I have this thing where I have to read something new for each reading. So I'm going to read some new poems. And this one is actually so new that it's not done. But I will read it anyway. Has no title. Negative space was colonized by Mallarmé, the whitening of zeros and foam. Horror has many owners in the ocean's cusp, where the swirl overtakes a body. These crabs like crawling starlit spiders or flowers with sudden legs. We desire to theorize the crabs teeming. These girls climbed across the beach. They found the woman at night. She woke up covered in crabs. But the gender's hold gets crowded, overcome by the all-over pinching. Pain that moved from everywhere and the briny sugar after crunch as they enter the mouth. The professionals could not find the bodies, let alone reconcile their state to the general state of bodies. The general state of bodies leaned into the space the missing ones held together. In a dim light, they all seemed to be dancing like exhausted people in embrace. Ammonia meat drenched in rice wine kept the professionals away. Alien fish that sustains people through the winter. Then in the warmer months, the salt harvest. Former enslaved salt workers say that even the thought or mention of salt makes them grind their teeth. In Busan, children caught in street cleaning operations, kidnapped to labor in factories producing fish hooks and shoe rubber bottoms for export, carried loads of dirt and assembled ballpoint pens, objects too big to go through a sieve. Operations like this require massive cooperation to sustain this death world. Collaborators overseeing the project of nation, of regional development. Petty managers of dictatorship. Flesh preservers of capitalism. And these are, as a short series of poems that are more or less done. And they are all sort of like a series of small worlds, imaginary or real. This one's called Ring World. Like a rat, like a rat, like a rat, like a rat. The world awakes and animates itself again, swarmed with dirty powers. Power of approaching death like a pratfall. Power of entering a hole and coming out in greenery. Above the rat's door, a drawing of a tiger keeps watch. Unattainable guardians who run errands also always fail. The tiger can't recognize the dangers for the rat. The tiger's metal detector nose searches, comes up gold. Wedding rings stick to the nose. The rat chews on bail bonds and sticks them into a cheek pouch. Tobacco laced with taxidermy dust. Stunt queen rat miss, my flesh melts the icy river of souls. Underneath the tech and frack schools of the nostalgic future, her real domain, her loop-de-loop. Spice World. I had a really complicated red pleather garment in mind when I held your mouth. So busy was I making my way through the illusory details and lock flaps, a thumbnail worm exploring a void file. I couldn't tell if I wanted to live there or wear it or see someone else in it. Not the kind of place that required rent, or at least the question of rent was deferred, since finding the entrance or exit meant negotiating with a goddess of spice pots, a tongue scooping slow flames, fingers splitting into solar delay, so that when warmth reached for you, it took a while to get there. Brick World. History doesn't die. In the lumps of the earth, in the clouds of gray blood, in the clotted abuse which cohered into clods, their thumps like relatives of a coffin. As I throw these grenades, you taught me this film about trashing. You balled me up under the tree. Now I come up with the roots, the knitting that clings to me. A coarse bread, partly ground, unmixed, ashes and vegetable. History doesn't die. It bricks through the theft of property until there is give. It's in the rot matter deposited on the riverbank, teeming with secret catharsis. It's in the leftover alluvia of salt making and gold making and sugar making. It sticks to our skins that refuse to stick to ourselves. Fine World. I broke the kudzu creep to south. I broke the threshing corn. I broke buckwheat flowers in winter. I broke the unprofitable progeny. I broke the spurge leaves for milk. I broke the moth wings for transmission. I broke liquid clear from its curl and said, listen to me, said you can't hurt me no more. I broke open and a sound so windowless whistled from me, made lines into the terminus filling with sand. You're blown, it said, the world's blown. And in the demilitarized clay of my body, some name, some stroke, separated from I, broke throat, surging broke, that epithet that lives with and against us. This is a poem about Emily Dickinson. It's called Emily Dickinson's House. Emily Dickinson asked me to build her a house. She had the paperwork I needed for the city zoning office shredded in her dress pocket. I just had to tape it together. So I labored for hours with a flashlight in my mouth. She did not pay me because she said it was love. I had to hawk her book to an Ivy League bookstore. For $5, I could put toward a bottle of water and train fare. So I could go to the city zoning office, where I finally waved my piece of paper around, full of seismic transparency, like the pale waves that photos of the moon mark astral collisions. The blueprints were sewn onto my body against forgetfulness. Later, when it was dark, I said I was hungry. Later, when the house was built, I opened the door, but the center of the house was empty. The frame fell away around us. Emily Dickinson was very unhappy. In secret, I built another house, this time just with red clay dragged out with my fingers from the bottom of the river. The roof, I thought, was a little like my face peering up, so I put sunscreen on it to protect it. I did not have any more train fare or any more papers for the city zoning office. Unseen, I lived in this house. unseen and still true, in the dark of the house, I no longer said I was hungry. Bits of red clay rubbed onto my skin at night. One day, Emily Dickinson saw the red evidence. Rather than explain, I told her I had a lover, actually many of them, and they all liked to eat red clay. She grew small and cramped as she listened to my lies. She petitioned the city to turn the river into a canal of cables. Copper displaced red, mylar displaced mud, petroleum jelly displaced water, optical fiber displaced my secrets, steel wire displaced her body. By the time the river was disappeared, Emily Dickinson was so small. She was a poisonous frog who clung to my long hair. Only her hands were human-sized. Her new proportions gave her new power. She asked me again to build her a house. She had stolen all my words, so I said nothing, just walked away and into the unseen house. I began to draw its blueprint in reverse. I write a lot of poems with my mom. And then I was like, oh, I'm writing a lot of poems about my mom. And then this container ship was stranded, and I was like, that container ship reminds me of my mom. So that's the story behind these poems. Motherships. One, Samsung. Please recognize my mother. She is embedded on a bankrupt Hanjin container ship with a limb or finger on the emergency brake. She won't stop calling me, and I won't pick up. But if you care to vocalize progression as an ember falls from the sky onto the embargoed mothership with loads of alien cargo just sitting there, please recognize her in a cloud, rushing empty and huge towards the shore. In her flaming opacity, an emergent genealogy that has strands perking. It's a fucking disaster, someone mutters to no one. It's so hot, the new normal, someone else says with bright sarcasm. It's all collapsing, another says behind me. And when I turn around, it is my mother, and her arms are full of phones. Two, Hyundai. Wrapped up in her shell, I thought, this is what love is. When misrecognition sticks, we call it that. And it is true that capital birthed me too, glued to a hull speeding off beetle-like. On the Hyundai Merchant Marine website for awareness of global citizenship, a Korean girl holds up an empty frame. For customer appreciation, a white family with two children on the beach. The website copy reads, "The symbolic meaning of oceans is sometimes a challenge." The longer I tried to avoid the apocalyptic, the harder it came, skipping work stoppage and flagging sails into full oceanic duress. Three, Korean Air. She loves the seaweed soup they serve on board. For an airplane, she qualifies. She frowns at the K-drama playing, so unrealistic that they end up with three children. Pen to sea. The big P and little H of fantasy pops from her with joyful disdain. She has three children. She pours oil from a packet into the swirl of hot water. I'm gonna read a few more poems. These are some love poems that I wrote this summer, or last summer, when I was both feeling horrible about the world and in love. which seems to happen a lot. So this one's love pools. Flush and teenage, I began life in a pool. Jump in with my dress, ballooning. Life opens this way. On a farm that grows nothing, that keeps no animals, driven by hunger, I jump in the pool, my hair radiant to begin. In the beginning, I am cold. For the hours after birth, twisting in a towel, all the citizens know the story of my birth. Every pore weeping chlorine, and the weeping is golden, and the bits of gold catch feeling. The feeling catches in my mouth, and I keep it there. Every time I gather these lights, they fall into my body, into unsure and slanted places. And they jostle as the pop songs do, slam into each other, breakless, body to body, as they rhyme nation to party, durational testing the amphetamine of night. Floating under a jacaranda blanket stitched with secret commentary, I dreamed your comment citing a book and an author. I dreamed this parallel world. I birthed this author. I raised her, fed her. I gave her a sister. I wrote her whole book. I wrote the comment and the cited passage. I dreamed of a you freely offering your thought. I dreamed the thoughts mingled with the wet of the bodies under the glowing blossoms. I woke up thinking this was everywhere, a commentary of the sky. I soak in this infinity pool, a cascade's unbroken loop, a beaded hole and thread. Is your question a multitude question? I feel it tangle the lights. I feel it pollinate hourly, the manyness coming up, that manied mouth touches yours over time, marking before now, and after now, and now, and now, and now. Hold. Death is political, but our politics are not adequate. Tonight, all the ugly feelings previously memorialized return. Like the earth is cut up. Like fuck this migration of fear across and out from woundedness. Like fuck state and capital and how nothing is for us. Except this love is something, and I don't want that to be about containment. I want this too to be in excess. If the air is gonna bleed like this, let go, hold tight. I have one more, this will be the last poem. This is called Corporeal Punishment. This is a story of how sometimes you become the fucked up one. First, you begin as a soft, soft body. Then you forge that plasmatic feeling, mold it into hard, hard coin, stamp it with an anchor mark, let it cool. Sometimes you're the fucked up one, but it is hard to feel it. Depending on how awake you are in the early morning's pollinated refusal, saying no. Sometimes so awake, but being so soft in body. The other statuary are rooted, but you, a soft bag of coins, tosses around, turns around. We didn't fall into the world. You love slapstick, not only because of falling and failing, but because of an ass-oriented version of the world. Because humiliation mixed into a spliff in the orange humid dark. Flaring into verdant space like a plant coming into other plants. Who woke up so early, undid the padlocks, and let you out? Rolling in the cool dew, you wonder how you arrived here. You try to understand the methods of what is between people. How many times is the adequate punishment? What lies on the other side of this freedom? The glaring look you cast in the moment of hopelessness. The math is strange. The coin called friendship keeps taunting you, lingering, spinning near your head. Sometimes you're the fucked up one because you can't return the favor. Sometimes you're the fucked up one because you think you did someone a favor. Sometimes you're the fucked up one because the favor backfires. Mistaking aggression for rigor. Mistaking rigor for aggression. Mistaking either for the erotics of anger. Mistaking the erotics of anger for being sure. Mistaking being sure for another kind of doing in the world. In the sliding line between the familiar and the supernatural, it's easy to become the fucked up one. You misheard the lyric and thought about lantern light filling a car, bright to a fault, shooting past the blotted out signs. It's easy to drink too much coffee and say things that you feel but can't yet mean. You always hope the country song will eviscerate your love of a place. To be immersed in loss has a way of turning the heart. So you put it on repeat to be beaten by its waters. Everything you do kind of guarantees holes in your teeth and stomach. Little acid bodies eating, rotting into the soft, unsuspecting places. The ones who are desperate to stay relevant stay bleeding. They love to organize the blood. But you know too much about the blows designed for pain, not marks, where no blood shows, even bruises are rare. Highly technical practices to avoid the blood vessels. Burning for days with a slow under-earth fire, you develop your invisible wet glare. A glare like days of rain hitting a canal. All these spaces are designed not to keep you. What you remember is a scene of blows. To always know the blow is coming, but to hope against it every time. And when the body wants to crumple, it glares. A flash of light that obscures.